We took turns buying each other beers every time I tracked him down. He'd tell me all about his days in the Coast Guard down in Corpus Christi. Thanks to Sarge's stories and the hospitality of the Cantina Azteca, I was 30 minutes late for lunch. When I finally got to Tycoon Flats on North St. Mary's, the tables in the burger joint's courtyard were filling up with college kids from Trinity and lunch-hour businessmen. It was overcast and humid. Heavy kitchen smoke drifted through the mesquite trees into the laundry lines of the unpainted houses behind the restaurant. The whole neighborhood smelled like well-done bacon cheeseburgers. Milo Chavez wasn't hard to spot. At a green picnic table halfway across the courtyard sat 350 pounds of human boulder, neatly packaged in 52-inch pleated gray trousers and a white dress shirt that had probably been custom-tailored for most of a hot air balloon. He wore gold accents from his stud earrings to his Gucci loafer buckles. His hair was newly razor-cut to a thin black stubble, which made his coppery face seem even more huge. The Latino Buddha with fashion sense. Sitting across from Milo was an older Anglo man who was trying to impersonate a Navy pilot. I might have fallen for the pressed khakis and aviator's glasses, but the leather flight jacket was overkill. His mouth was too soft, his gray-blonde eyebrows a little too twitchy and nervous for a Navy man. He was frowning and holding out his fingers in cat's cradle position and speaking to Milo in low but insistent tones. I caught, "I will not," several times. I tried to read Milo's face, but there was nothing there except Milo's standard sleepy, almost bovine calm. Of course, that didn't mean anything. Milo had looked calm when he'd run into me at Mi Tierra the week before and told me about the demo tape problem that might lose his agency a $1 million contract. He'd looked calm at our high school senior party when he'd shoved Kyle Mavery's face into the sour cream dip for making snide comments about Chavez's parents having green cards. He'd looked calm in college, after we'd just been shot at by a Berkeley house owner whose neglected dog Milo and I had decided to liberate. He'd even looked calm 2 years after that when he was fired from his first job at Terrence and Goldman Law offices, after Milo's brilliant idea for tracking down a material witness had landed me in the IC unit at San Francisco General. After many years of on-and-off friendship, I still could never tell when Milo was about to crack a joke or erupt into violence or convince me to do something dangerous and stupid that would sound, coming from Milo, like the sanest course of action in the world. Hanging around him for any length of time did not rate highly on the Trace Navarre funometer. I plopped down with my Shiner Bock long neck and my basket of curly fries next to the pilot. I flicked him a salute. "Permission to come aboard." The pilot stared at me. "Who the hell?" Milo gave me a slight shake of the head. "Trace Navarre, meet John Cray, Miranda Daniels' producer." "Ex-producer," Cray amended. "Pleased as punch," I looked at Milo. "I've been calling you since yesterday morning, Chavez. I'm beginning to feel unloved." Milo raised his hand, then returned his attention to Cray. "You can't walk away from this, Johnny. Are you going to give up your 10% of the final project?" Cray laughed. His eyebrows twitched. "There isn't going to be any final project, Chavez. You're talking about 50 more hours in the studio by next Friday. Only spec time. That's crazy. Even if I wasn't fed up with the fucking redneck scare tactics. Jesus! Did you see the bullet hole, Milo?"
"Les is working on things," Milo promised.
Cray stabbed the picnic table with his middle finger. "If Les is working on things, I want to know why he's unreachable while I'm getting shot at. Where is the son of a bitch?"
"I told you, Nashville, the developmental deal with Century. The developmental deal is history.
I came here to see Les and some money and some serious signs that I'm going to get protection."
He glanced at me briefly, snorted.
"I don't see anything like that. I've got other things to do, Milo. Adios." John Cray got up, straightened his jaw and his aviator glasses and his flight jacket, and left in a wake of Old Spice. He did it so fast I forgot to come to attention.
Milo stared at his food, then at mine. He reached over, appropriated the largest fry in my basket, and began uncurling it meticulously between his massive fingers.
He dresses almost as snappy as you, I said. Milo's features move slowly, if they move at all. You pretty much have to rely on his eyes. Now they were dark and concentrated. Angry.
Johnny used to manage Mel Tillis, he told me. They did a show once on an aircraft carrier. The whole road crew got those flight jackets. It kind of went to Johnny's head.
What was he talking about just now? Milo ate the smallest bite of fry.
More trouble with Miranda's Century Records deal. Sunday night, somebody took some pot shots at Cray as he was coming out of the studio around midnight. He heard a pop, pop. Took him a few seconds to realize it was a gun. Police came, found a slug in the doorway, said they'd get right on it.
A sniper? Like with Julie Kearns. Thanks for telling me.
I was meaning to, man.
Sure, right after you got through laying flowers on Julie's grave. Milo gave me a bland look.
Kearns made my life hell. She stole from us. What do you expect me to do, cry?
No, I wouldn't expect that from you, but Julie Kearns didn't steal your damn demo tape, Milo. I told him about my last few days of surveillance, up to and including my falling out with Irania, and my feelings that maybe I'd be looking for some other kind of work in the not-too-distant future. Milo finished dissecting and eating the curly fry. He produced an individual wet wipes packet from his pocket, ripped it open, and began wiping the grease off his fingers carefully, cleaning under his nails. I caught the scent of lemon.
I'm sorry, Navarre. Is that what you want to hear? You want to cut loose from this and leave it to the police? Nothing's stopping you. Listen, I'll figure out something. Bullshit.
Milo's black eyes drifted back toward me.
What was that?
You and St. Pierre aren't figuring out a damn thing, Milo, and your problem is bigger than a missing demo tape. People are getting shot at here. One of them is dead. What the fuck is going on?
He gave me the look of a bull that was just a little too sleepy to charge. You know who Les St. Pierre is, Trace? Every artist that's come out of Texas since 1980... Les has either booked their dates or managed them or both. Miranda Daniels isn't the first artist he's gotten flack for stealing from her local sponsors, for taking her to the big league. He's handled worse.
Why am I not convinced? Milo put his hand flat on the picnic table. He drummed his fingers slowly, one at a time, like he was making sure they all still worked.
I like this job, Navarre. It's not just legal commissions, you know. I'm starting to sell my own dates at 15%. Miranda Daniels gets the Century Records deal. People are going to start knowing my name.
I'm still not hearing any answers.
Are you willing to keep working for me?
I've worked for a lot of lawyers, Milo. You know what I hate about it? They always have to test you. They give you one small corner of a case and wait to see how you'll handle it. Sometimes that caution works out okay. More often it leaves you operating with a dangerously incomplete picture and somebody winds up hurt. Seeing as we've known each other for 15 years, seeing as we've been down this road before, I figured we'd be skipping the test stage. I guess I was wrong. Milo tapped his fingers.
All right.
All right what?
I made some calls about you over the last week after you agreed to look at Julie Kearns.
Calls, I repeated. What kind of calls?
Roger Schumann, for one. He said you did nice work. Said you threw a loan shark through his office window extremely well. Manny Forrester had good things to say, too. Seems you know how to get discrete results with skip traces. He said if all his thugs had PhDs, maybe they'd be as reliable as you.
You called for references. On me. Milo shrugged.
It's been a long time since San Francisco, Navarre. I figured you'd turn out to be good at this kind of work. I was glad to find out I was right.
No more tests, Milo. What's going on? Milo started to say something, then stopped. He tapped his fingers.
Les isn't in Nashville. He's been missing for over 2 weeks.
I took a plastic knife, reached over, and cut off half of the uneaten cheeseburger in Milo's basket. And you haven't told the police, even after what happened to Julie Kearns?
It's not that simple. Les...
Milo searched for the right phrase, something legally neutral. Finally, he gave up.
Les screws up a lot. He's eccentric. He drinks. He has some other bad habits. Sometimes he'll go off on a binge for a few days, and we'll have to cover by saying he's out of town, like we're doing now. I can't be sure. Has he ever been gone this long before?
Milo shook his head.
But still.
His voice trailed off in disappointment, not buying what he was about to say.
You think his disappearance might be connected to the missing demo tape, I said. And the gunshots at John Cray, now Julie Kearns' murder? You think it might all be part of a package, somebody pissed off because of this deal you're working on?
That's what I'm afraid of.
The wife hasn't reported Les missing? The look of distaste on Milo's face told me Mrs. St. Pierre was not his favorite subject.
Let me tell you about Les St. Pierre and his wife and the police. About 6 months ago, the last time Les took off, Allison went to missing persons. You know what they told her?
I ate some cheeseburger. I waited.
They told her Les was already missing. For 7 years. Seems a former girlfriend had the same problem with him disappearing. Reported Les and forgot to let the police know when he'd come home. The Bureau never bothered to follow up, take him off the rolls. Can you believe that?
It's been known to happen. MPB is flooded with domestics that are resolved 90% of the time before they're even assigned.
Yeah, well, this time Allison isn't in any hurry. Les joked from time to time about running away to Mexico. Allison figures maybe he finally did it and she's not crying any tears.
We're not talking just missing persons this time, Milo. Homicide is going to want to talk to Les. You've got to tell them. Milo pulled on the back of his neck.
It's more complicated than that, Navarre. It's one thing for our clients to think Les is eccentric, that he slips out of pocket for a few days now and then, that his wife reports him gone after a fight or whatever. People can give him some slack there because he's Les St. Pierre. But the minute somebody hears a rumor he's honest to God missing, that I'm looking for him, that it's just Milo holding down the fort.
He raised his hands off the table.
I need to find Les quickly and quietly. I don't have time to shop around for help.
You know how to flatter a guy. He reached into his pocket and pulled out a money roll only Milo could have carried without his pants bulging obscenely. $50 bills wrapped as thick as a Coke can.
Your boss doesn't like the case? We can cut out the middleman.
No, I said. I don't have my own license. At this point, it looks like I might never.
That's just as well.
I told you, I'm thinking about getting out of this line of work. Milo put the cylinder of money sideways on the table and rolled it in my direction.
You're going to look into Kern's murder anyway, Navarre. You couldn't put down something that happened on your watch. I know you better than that. Why not let me pay you?
Maybe I felt like I owed him. Or maybe I was thinking about how long I'd known him off and on since high school, always reconnecting with each other at the least opportune moments like bad acoustical echoes. Or maybe I'm kidding myself. Maybe what swayed me more was that roll of money. The prospect of paying my rent on time for once and not having to borrow grocery money from my mother. I heard myself saying, "What exactly do you want me to do?"
Chapter 7. The Les St. Pierre Talent Agency was a gray and maroon Victorian on West Ashby, across the street from the Kohler Museum. Even without a sign in front, you could tell the old residence had been converted for business. The power color combination, the uniform blinds on the windows, the well-kept but totally impersonal landscaping, the Texas flag windsock hanging on the empty front porch, it all screamed, office building. There were two cars already parked at the bottom of the hill in front. One was a tan Volvo wagon. When I met Milo on the sidewalk, he was staring at the other. A glistening black pickup truck that looked like it had been converted at great expense from a semi-rig. It had wheels just shy of monster size, tinted windows with security alarm decals on the corners, orange pinstriping,
mud flaps with silver silhouettes of Barbie doll women on them. The cab looked like it could sleep four comfortably. Milo said, "This isn't my day." Before I could ask what he meant, he turned and lumbered up the steps. Inside, the Victorian was all hardwood floors and cream-colored walls. A staircase led up from the main foyer. The double doorway on the right opened into a reception area with a couple of wicker chairs, a mahogany desk, a fireplace, and a Turkish rug. A very big Anglo man in his early 50s was sitting on the edge of the desk, talking with Gladys, the receptionist. When I say very big, and I'm standing next to Milo, I have to correct myself. This guy wasn't like Milo, but he was big by any other definition. Tall and barrel-chested, thick neck, powerful hands. He had the build of a derrick worker. Despite the heat, he wore a denim jacket over his white shirt, new blue jeans, black Justin boots. He was twirling a Stetson on one finger while he talked. When he saw Milo, his smile hardened. "Hola, Mario!" Milo walked placidly to the desk and picked up a stack of mail. He didn't look at his visitor.
"Fuck you, Sheckley. You know my name."
"Hey, now!" Sheckley spoke with a twangy, hard-edged accent of a German Texan, someone who'd grown up in the hill country around Fredericksburg, where many of the family still spoke a brand of cowboy Deutsch.
"Play nice with me, son. I just dropped by to see how things are coming along. Have to make sure you're doing right by my girl. You remind Les about that contract yet?"
Milo kept flipping through his mail.
"Les is still in Nashville. I'll tell him you dropped by. The contract's right next to the toilet where he left it."
Sheckley's laugh was a rich chuckle. He kept twirling the Stetson.
"Come on now, son. You want to dispute our agreement, you've got to put me in touch with the boss man. Otherwise, I'm expecting Miranda in the split rail studio come November 1st, and I'll tell you what else. You send Century that demo, and I'll send them a copy of my contract. See if they want to sink their money into a girl who's going to bring their legal department a mess of business."
Milo opened another letter.
"You know where the door is."
Sheckley got up from the desk slowly, told the receptionist,
"You think about it,"
then started walking out. In front of me, he stopped and offered to shake.
"Tilden Sheckley. Most people call me Sheck."
Up close, it looked like all the unnecessary pigments in Mr. Sheckley's face had drained into his tan, which was dark and perfect. His eyes were so bleached blue they were almost white. His lips had no red at all. His hair had probably been thick and chocolatey at one time. It had faded to a dusty brownish gray, uncombable tufts that looked like clumps of moth wings. I told him my name.
"I know who you are," he said. "I knew your father."
Lots of people knew my father. Sheck grinned, but it wasn't friendly. He looked like I'd missed the joke.
"I suppose so. Most of them didn't contribute as much as I did."
Then he put on the Stetson and said goodbye. When he was gone, Milo turned to Gladys.
"What do you mean, think about it?"
Gladys said Sheck had offered her a secretarial job with a 50% pay raise. She said she turned him down. She sounded a little wistful about it. Milo stared at the space on the desk where Sheck had been sitting. He looked like he was contemplating putting his fist through the mahogany.
"You do those calls yet?"
Gladys shook her head. She launched into a long story about how some club owner in San Marcos had called and complained that Eli Watts and his Sunrisers had torn up the hotel room he'd rented for them, and now he wanted the agency to pay the damages. Gladys had spent her entire morning trying to smooth things out. I thought the desk was going to get it, but slowly Milo's meaty fists unclenched. He mumbled something under his breath, then led me down the hall and into his office. Everything in the converted parlor had been custom-made for Milo's comfort. Two massive red leather chairs, a half-ton oak desk with a 21-inch computer monitor, and a candy bowl the size of a basketball. Bookshelves that started as high as most bookshelves stopped and went all the way to the ceiling. The only thing small was Milo's Rosewood Yamaha acoustic in the corner.
the same guitar he used to bring on our drunken college road trips into the Sonoma wine country. There was still a crescent-shaped dent near the sound hole where I'd thrown a beer can at Milo and missed. I sat across the desk from Milo. On the right wall were framed pictures of Les St. Pierre's past and present artists. I recognized several country stars, nobody recent, nobody I would have considered huge. Prominently displayed in the center was a photo of the Miranda Daniels Band, six people at a bar in a honky-tonk, all facing out toward the camera and trying to look casual, like they lined up that way every night. Julie Kearns and Miranda Daniels were shoulder to shoulder in the middle, sitting up on the bar with their cowboy boots crossed at the ankles and their denim skirts carefully arranged to show some calf. Miranda looked about 25, her hair dark and shoulder length, just curly enough to look tangled. Petite body, almost boyish, an unremarkable face. In this shot, she was smiling, looking out the corner of her eye at Julie Kearns, who got caught mid-laugh. With the airbrushing, you almost couldn't tell Julie was older than Miranda. The two good old boys on their right were in their 60s. One had a trimmed white beard and a healthy belly. The other was tall, with no body fat at all, and thinning greasy black hair. The men on the left were younger, both in their 40s, one with longish blonde hair and a thick build and an OP t-shirt, the other with dark curly hair and a black cattleman's coat and black hat and a scowl that was probably supposed to be James Dean-esque, but didn't quite make it. The cattleman looked quite a bit like Miranda Daniels, but 20 years older. On the wall behind the picture was a pale square halo that told me the band's photo had superseded somebody else's whose picture had been slightly larger. Milo followed my eyes to the photo on the wall.
"They're not important," he assured me. "The old fart with the white beard is Miranda's dad, Willis. The guy in the Wyatt Earp outfit is her big brother, Brent. You know, new, Julie. The thin, greasy one is Ben French. The burly surfer reject is Cam Compton."
"Miranda's brother and her dad are in the band?" Milo spread his hands.
"Welcome to Hillbilly World. Funny thing is, until about 2 years ago, Miranda was considered the untalented one in the family. Then Tilden Sheckley, the lovely human being you just met, took an interest in her."
"Sheckley is part of your problem." Milo reached for his candy bowl.
"Butterscotch or peppermint?"
"Definitely butterscotch." He threw me a roll of midget lifesavers, then took two for himself.
"Sheck owns the big honky-tonk on the way to Medina Lake. The Indian paintbrush, you know the place?"
I nodded. Anybody who'd ever driven toward Medina Lake knew the Indian paintbrush. Plopped next to the highway in the middle of several hundred acres of rock and dirt, the dance hall looked like the world's largest portable John, a white corrugated metal box big enough to accommodate a shopping mall. "Paintbrush Enterprises," I speculated, "the company who's been sending Julie Kearns biweekly deposits." Milo stared at me.
"Do I want to know how you got access to her bank account?"
"No." He cracked a smile.
"Sheck is known for promoting pet acts, usually pretty younger women. He lets them open for his headliners on weekends, sometimes gets them into his house band. Sooner or later, he gets them into bed. He manages their careers for 50% of the profit, milks them as long as he can. Once upon a time, that was Julie Kearns. Julie acted like a good girl, so even when she stopped bringing in crowds, Sheckley kept her on the payroll, doing his spreadsheets, designing promotionals, occasionally opening for somebody. Miranda Daniels was going to be Sheckley's next project. Then, Les signed her out from under Sheck's nose."
"And Sheckley still thinks he owns her." Milo nodded. "And you and Les disagree?" Milo unwrapped his lifesavers and dumped them in his mouth. He brushed his hands, slid out the side drawer of his desk, and produced a legal-sized document.
"You heard Sheckley mention a contract just now?"
I nodded. Milo slid the paper across to me.
"Before we signed Miranda Daniels, Sheck had all kinds of plans for her. He was going to put her first album out on this little regional label he owns, Split Rail Records. He was going to tour around small clubs in the States and Europe, be her sugar daddy. He probably stood to make about a quarter of a mil off her. Miranda stood to make shit. Minimal sales and no national exposure. That was Sheck's plan, only he never put anything in writing. Probably he couldn't imagine Miranda'd be crazy enough to cross him. Then, Les signed her away from him. Sheck screamed and hollered, but there wasn't much he could do. The band was mostly Sheck's old protégés, Julie, Cam Compton, Ben French, but there wasn't much they could do either. They went along with the new arrangement. It wasn't until Les got Century Records interested in hearing Miranda's solo demo tape that Sheckley suddenly waltzed into our office with that. I scanned the document. It was a poor-quality photostat of an agreement dated last July, signed by Tilden Sheckley and Les St. Pierre as Miranda's manager. All the legalese seemed to boil down to one main promise, that Tilden Sheckley would have first option on any performances or recordings by Miranda Daniels for the next 3 years. I looked at Milo. This means Sheckley could veto the deal with Century Records? Exactly. Is the contract valid? Hell no. Les screamed bloody murder when he read it. It's a forgery, the oldest bluff tactic in the book. Sheckley's just trying to scare away a potential buyer, and Les wasn't about to fall for it. So, what's the problem? The problem is, it's a very effective bluff. Major labels are skittish about new talent. To prove the contract invalid, Les would have to go to court, make Sheckley produce the original document. Sheckley could delay for months, drag things out until Century lost interest in Miranda or found another place to sink their money. The window of opportunity for a deal like this shuts pretty damn quick. And Les isn't around to challenge it. Milo held his hand out for the contract. I gave it back. He stared at it distastefully, then folded it and filed it away. Les said he had a plan to get Sheckley's balls in a squeeze, something to make Sheck withdraw the contract and do anything else Les told him to do. Les had been spending a lot of time with Julie Kearns since we took over management of the band. Les said she was going to help him out. Blackmail? Knowing Les, I don't doubt it. I warned him to be careful of Julie Kearns. She'd been working too long with Sheckley. She was still taking his money. Julie was sweet to Les, but I saw her other side. She was bitter, short-tempered, jealous as hell. She complained about how Miranda was going to go down the same way she had, that it was just a matter of time. Julie said Miranda should be more grateful, keep Julie around for all her experience once Miranda signed with Century. He sighed. Les wouldn't listen to me about Kearns. They'd gotten pretty close over the last month. I'm not sure how close, to tell you the truth. Then he disappeared. I was hoping if you kept tabs on Julie...
Milo rapped his knuckles lightly on the desk. He scowled.
I don't know what I thought. But it looks like Sheckley got his problem solved very neatly. First Les, now Julie. Whatever they are planning to do to get Sheck's claws off Miranda Daniels, it isn't going to happen now.
I found myself looking again at the photo on the wall, at the unimpressive face of Miranda Daniels. Milo must have guessed my thoughts.
You haven't heard her sing, Navarre. Yes, she's worth the trouble.
There's got to be other country singers around. Why would a guy like Tilden Sheckley get bent out of shape over one that broke out of the stable? Milo opened his mouth, then closed it again. He looked like he was reorganizing what he wanted to say.
You don't know Sheck, Navarre. I told you, he let some of his well-behaved artists like Julie Kearns stick around after they're washed up. One of Sheck's less cooperative girls ended up at the bottom of a motor lodge pool. Freak swimming accident. Another male singer who tried to get out from under Sheckley's thumb was busted with a gram of cocaine in his glove compartment, got 3 years of hard time. The deputies in Sheck's county handled both cases. Half the Avalon Sheriff's Department works security at the paintbrush on their off hours. You figure it out. Still, Les and Sheck had a history, Trace. I don't know all the bloody details, but I know they've been at each other's throats over one deal or another for years. I think this time Les went a little too far trying to twist Sheckley's arm. I think Sheckley finally decided to solve the problem the way Sheck knows best. I need you to tell me for sure.
I unwrapped a butterscotch and put it in my mouth. Three conditions.
Name them.
First, you don't lie to me. You don't withhold anything again. If I ask you for a top 10 list, you give me 11 items.
Done.
Second, get better candy.
Milo smiled. And third, you bring in the police.
Talk to the wife, set it up any way you want. Put the best face on it. Call it a silly necessity to your clients, but you level with SAPD about St. Pierre being gone.
You have to get his name into the system. I won't poke around for 2 or 3 more weeks, then find out I've been failing to report another homicide or a killer. You can't seriously think less.
You said Julie and Les were getting close. Julie is now dead. If the police start looking around and can't find St. Pierre, what are they going to think?
You've got to level with them. I told you, I can't just go.
I got my backpack off the floor and unzipped the side pocket. It was an old green nylon pack, a holdover from my grad days at Berkeley. It served me well in investigative work. Nobody cares much about grad students with backpacks. Nobody thinks you might be carrying burglar tools or recorders or fat rolls of $50 bills. I took out Chavez's money and put it on his desk. Then I stood up to leave.
Thanks for the chat, Milo.
Milo leaned back and pressed his palm to the center of his forehead like he was checking for a fever.
All right, Navarre, sit down.
You agree?
I don't have much choice.
The phone rang. Milo answered it with a hello that was mostly growl. Then his entire disposition changed. The emotion drained out of his voice and his face paled to the color of café latte. He leaned forward into the receiver.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Oh, no problem.
Les?
No, sir. What if... No. That's fine.
The conversation went on like that for about 5 minutes. Somewhere in the middle of it, I sat back down. I tried not to look at Milo. He sounded like an overwhelmed 10-year-old listening to Hank Aaron explain why he couldn't sign the kid's baseball card. When Milo hung up, he stared at the receiver, his fingers wrapped around the wad of money almost protectively. Century Records? I asked. He nodded. It's getting hard on you.
I didn't want to run the entire agency, Navarre. We've got 7 other artists touring right now. I've got promoters breathing down my neck about deals Les didn't even mention to me. Now, Century Records... I don't know how I'm going to hold the deal together when they find out Les is gone.
So, walk away. Milo seemed to turn the words around in his head. They must have rolled unevenly, like rocks in a tumbler.
What do you mean?
Let the agency collapse if it has to. You've got your law degree, you seem to know what you're doing. What do you need the charades for?
Milo shook his head. I need St. Pierre's clout. I can't do it on my own.
Okay.
You don't believe me.
I shrugged. Somebody once told me my problem was thinking too small, that I should just take a chance and throw myself into the kind of work I really liked. The hell with what people said. Of course, that advice got me a knife in the chest a week later. Maybe you don't want to follow it. Milo's eyes traced a complete circle around the room, like they were following the course of a miniature train. When they refocused on me, his voice was tightly controlled, angry.
Are you going to help me or not?
The Century Records deal, is that important to you? Milo made a fist.
You don't get it, do you, Navarre? Right now, Miranda Daniels is making about $1,500 a gig. That's payment for the whole band, if she's lucky. She has minimal name recognition in Texas. Suddenly, Century Records, one of the biggest Nashville labels, says they're interested enough to offer a developmental deal. They give her money for a demo,
30 days in the studio, and if they like what comes out of that, she's guaranteed a major contract. That would mean over $1 million up front. Her price per gig would go up by a factor of 10, and my commission would go up with it. Other people in the industry would suddenly take me seriously, not just as Les St. Pierre's Step and Fetch It. You have any idea what it's like having somebody dangle that possibility in front of you and knowing that a jerk like Tilden Sheckley could screw it up? I nodded. So, what's our deadline? Milo looked down, unclenched the fist, rubbed his hand flat against the desktop. Miranda's master demo is due to Century next Friday. I've got that long to get the recording redone and to figure out a way to keep Sheck quiet about this forged contract. Otherwise, there's a good chance Century will renege on their offer. 10 days, Navarre. Then, if all goes well, maybe I'll take your advice. I'll ask Miranda to let me represent her and let the rest of the agency go to hell. There was a knock on the door. Gladys stuck her head in and said that Conwell and the boys were here for the 5 minutes Milo had promised them last week. They'd brought a tape. Milo started to tell Gladys to send them away, but then changed his mind. He told her they should come on down. When she closed the door again, Milo said,
"Unsolicited demo tapes. I could build a house out of what we've got in the back room, but you never know. I try not to blow people off."
He pushed the money back to me.
"Just ask Gladys for the files on your way out. She'll know what you mean. It's some background material I put together, stuff you would need to know."
You assumed I would stay on the case.
"Read the files over. And it's about time you met Miranda Daniels. She's playing at the Cactus Cafe in Austin tomorrow night. You know the place?"
I nodded. "Julie Kearns' death isn't going to make you cancel the gig?" My comment might as well have been a sneeze for all it registered.
"Just come check Miranda out, see what the fuss is about. Then we could talk."
I didn't protest very hard. I dropped the roll of 50s back in my bag and promised to think things over. When I was at the door, Milo said,
"Navarre."
I turned. Milo was staring through me into the hallway.
"It'll be different this time. It's not like I feel good about the way things happened back then. Okay?"
It was the closest he'd ever come to an apology. I nodded. "Okay, Milo." Then Conwell and the boys were pouring in around me, all grins and new haircuts and coats and ties. Milo Chavez switched moods and started telling the musicians how glad he was they could drop by, how sorry he was that Les St. Pierre was out of town. I heard the easy laughter of the meeting all my way down the hall. Chapter 8. On my way out of the office, Gladys gave me a thick gray mailing envelope and told me to have a nice day. The chances of that happening went down considerably when I got outside and noticed Tilden Sheckley's black truck still in front of the agency. Sheckley himself was across the street, reclining in the passenger seat of my VW Bug. The afternoon was so humid the metal on the cars steamed. With a convertible top up, my VW would be about as comfortable as a pressure cooker. The fact that Sheck had probably been waiting there for a while cheered me up. I walked around to the driver's side, but didn't get in. Sheck was reading a book that I'd left on the floorboard. He'd taken off his Stetson and his denim jacket and set a Smith & Wesson revolver on the dash. "I know the cars look alike," I sympathized, "but yours is the one with the pinstripes." Sheck smiled up at me from his book, my book. I knew a kid in third grade who liked to set living things on fire with no warning. One minute you'd be sitting there laughing with him about the latest episode of H.R. Puffin Stuff, and the next he'd be holding a match to the shredded newspaper in the class guinea pig cage. His face never changed. Small, bright eyes like pilot lights, a wide, friendly smile that was totally disconnected from his brain.
He looked so sweet the teachers tolerated him right up to the day he poured gasoline in a sandbox full of kindergartners and tried to set it ablaze. Sheck's smile reminded me a lot of that kid. He hefted my book of medieval drama.
You really understand this muck?
He turned a page, then tried to read aloud a few lines from The Wakefield, Cain and Abel.
Not bad, I commented.
They'd pronounce the I, E. Like, E, am wondering what this guy is doing in my car. Sheck patted the driver's seat.
Come on in.
I make it a policy not to sit next to people with guns. He seemed to notice the revolver for the first time.
Oh, hell, son. Give this old man a handle. See why I carry him around.
He picked up the gun by the cylinder and offered me the stock. You're supposed to empty the chambers first, aren't you? Sheck laughed.
What perfect world do you live in, son? Just take the damn gun.
Thanks, no. He shrugged, then put the .41 back on the dashboard.
I'll be sorry when the revolver is history. Everybody nowadays is hot for semi-auto. Got to have a 12-round magazine. Truth is, this old man never got a chance. Finest damn revolver ever made. You know what it is?
Smith & Wesson, M58, I said. M&P style. Sheck nodded approval.
You're a gun lover.
I know guns, I corrected. I don't love them much. That statement apparently made as much sense to Sheck as the Middle English. He tried to interpret it, failed, then decided to keep talking.
.41 caliber round was perfect evolution, you understand. All the punch of a .44 with the velocity of a .357. This is the kind of gun your dad carried on the force back in the '70s. You know why they canned it?
I said I didn't.
Police were firing hot loads with it, full magnum capability. The muzzle blasts were scaring all the lady cops.
He laughed.
Then public relations started thinking the citizens would get mad. Cops with magnums blowing away all those helpless victims of society down in the barrio. A damn shame.
What do you want, Mr. Sheckley? Sheck put his finger in the book and closed it like he'd be coming back to it in a minute. Maybe he wanted to see how things worked out with Cain and God.
I'm just curious what kind of stories your compadre's been telling you. I figured you'd be walking out of there with a big retainer and a bigger load of horseshit.
Why exactly did you figure that? Sheck glanced to his right and smiled, like there was somebody there he wanted to share the joke with.
Come on, son. Old Milo would love to think I'm the boogeyman causing his every little problem.
Every little problem? You mean like Miranda Daniels' producer getting shot at, her demo tape stolen, Julie Kearns murdered? Those kinds of little problems? Sheckley kept smiling.
Hell, son, I ain't the one who decided Miranda needed a national deal. You understand, Century Records only wants her, don't you? The rest of the band, those boys don't stand to get nothing from this except a handshake. You want to know who's angry enough with Milo Chavez to cause some problems? You just think about that goddamn Century deal.
That's funny, I said.
What is?
You keep saying Milo. Les is the one with the agency. Is there some reason you're not worried about him? Sheck's smile didn't waver at all.
All right. Let me ask you about that. If Les St. Pierre is so all-powerful smart, what makes him hire a 300-pound wetback to sell country music to redneck bars? That make any business sense to you?
He raised his palm.
I'm serious now. I'm not trying to be mean here. I just don't get what was going through Les's head. I sure as hell wouldn't be out of town as much as he's been, leaving Gordo in charge. I'll deal with anybody I need to, don't get me wrong. But there's club owners a lot worse than me. They see Chavez coming.
He shook his head regretfully. That kind of thing's going to really hurt Miranda's job prospects. I looked at the blue S&W on my dashboard. Mr. Sheckley, it's hot out. The only air conditioning I've got in this convertible is called fourth gear. I'd like to get moving.
I'm just telling you, Trace. I worry about my friends, the Danielses. Willis and me go way back. I care about his daughter doing all right. Now, this agency's charging 10% for booking. Old Les is getting 40 more for management. For 50% of my career, if I was Miranda, I expect a damn sight better service.
And you're the better service.
That's right.
I hear you did wonders for that other girl you sponsored, the one in the swimming pool.
Sheck let out air between his teeth.
You could do yourself a favor right now and forget whatever horseshit Chavez has been feeding you. I'll do right by Miranda. You think some spick lawyer's gonna play straight with you about that? You think your daddy would be arguing against me here?
I counted to five.
Sheck, you like Sheck, right?
He nodded.
Honest, Sheck, I appreciate the concern. The thing is, the only load of manure I've come across today has been dumped in my passenger seat. I'd like it out of here.
Sheck's face darkened, but his eyes stayed as bright and colorless as high-octane fuel.
That was a mistake, son. I can overlook one mistake. When I was younger, I thought I was hot shit, too.
Are you going to get out of my car?
Sheck put my book back on the floorboard. He took his revolver off the dash and got out of the car.
I thought to level with you, Trace, because I knew your father. I never had any beef with him. I don't see any reason to have one with you. You want to talk, come on out to my place some night. I'll buy you a beer. But you get yourself tangled on the wrong side of the barbed wire when it comes to Miranda Daniels. I'll eat you for lunch.
There was no anger in his voice, no violent edge. He turned and walked with easy confidence across West Ashby back to his truck. He didn't even bother to holster the S&W.
Chapter 9. I got home around sunset, changed into exercise clothes, and ran through the basic stances. 5 minutes each, then 20 minutes of silk reeling exercises. Afterward, I lay on the floor until the sweat started to dry and the air conditioning felt cold again. Robert Johnson climbed up onto my chest and sat there, staring down at my face.
"What?" I said.
He yawned, showing me the black spots on the top of his mouth. His breath was not pleasant. I made our standard dinner, Frisky's tacos for him, chalupas for me. I showered and changed, then drank a shiner at the kitchen counter. My green neon KMAC wall clock read 7:05. Irene Manos would still be at the office typing up the daily client reports. The professors at UTSA would probably be in their offices too, preparing for night classes or yawning as they waded through bad undergraduate essays. I tried to imagine myself in either place. I couldn't quite do it. All I got in my head was a cartoon vision of me as Wile E. Coyote, my toes clinging to two different icebergs, doing the splits as they drifted farther and farther apart, in my hand a little wooden sign that read, "Yikes!" I looked at the thick gray envelope that was propped up by the sink. The maroon words Les St. Pierre Talent were printed in the upper right-hand corner, no return address, just like there'd been no number on the business card. You either knew what you needed to know to get in touch with Les St. Pierre, or you didn't merit the information. Cocky. I opened the envelope and started to read. On top of the stack, on a piece of yellow legal paper, Milo had brainstormed all the personal facts he knew about the missing talent agent. The list was surprisingly short. Date of birth, April 8, 1952. Place of birth, unknown. Somewhere near Texarkana, Milo thought. High school in Denton. A year of formal music training at North Texas State before St. Pierre had dropped out and joined the Air Force toward the end of Vietnam. In 76, he'd started his music industry career as a song plugger for a large Nashville publishing group. He'd been partially responsible for the surge in Texas music that had happened over the following few years. The birth of the Austin City Limits TV show with its videotaped studio concerts, the rise of Willie Nelson and the other outlaws, the sudden interest in places like Luckenbach and Gillies and Kerrville. Les had been a confirmed bachelor until 3 years ago when he'd met Allison Cassidy in Nashville. He and Allison now lived in Monte Vista, not far from the agency's office. On the back of the page was a list of Les's favorite bars and hangouts in San Antonio and Austin. That list was more extensive. Underneath the legal paper was a portrait studio photo of the God of Talent agents.
Les St. Pierre looked like a cross between Barry Manilow and an amateur prize fighter. His mouth was a colorless Cupid's bow, and his eyes were dark and soft. Maybe the unsuspecting could even mistake them as sensitive. His nose had started out as a fine, thin triangle, but had obviously been broken at least once. His neck, his cheekbones, and his brow were all a little too thick, a little too Neanderthal for Manilow. His hair was short and greasy and thinning, and his shirt was open to reveal a chest that was robust enough, but pale and hairless and somehow hollow-looking. There was a slightly haggard look to his face, and a dangerous quality, too. The kind of omnivorous hunger you see in drug addicts and car salesmen and low-rated talk show hosts. I skimmed through the rest of the package. A copy of Les's management contract with Miranda Daniels, a copy of the allegedly backdated agreement between Tilden, Sheckley, and Les, a list of present clients and how much the agency had grossed in commissions in the last 6 months. Just over $1 million altogether. There was a rundown on the last dates Les had personally sold and the last people he had spoken with. Tilden Sheckley and Julie Kearns were among them. The last person who'd seen Les St. Pierre was the lady who watered his plants. Les had walked out of his house in the morning of October 12th, told the horticulturist to lock up on her way out, then vanished into thin air. Neither of his two cars ever left the garage. Milo had formulated a list of 20 or 30 people Les had antagonized over the years. Tilden Sheckley's name was on top. Several other names were famous country singers. There was no list of Les's friends. I checked my watch. Still happy hour. I put the gray envelope and a wad of Milo's money into my backpack and headed out to make some friends in the service industry. 7 bars and a dozen tip me and maybe I'll remember something encounters later. I wasn't much wiser than when I'd started. I told everybody I was an old friend of Les's, trying to track him down. The bartender at the Broadway 50-50 complained that Les had an unpaid tab of $230. The manager at Diamond Rodeo said Les was a bloodsucker, but for God's sake, I shouldn't tell Les he said so. A singer named Tony Dell at La Puerta told me a great story about how Les had once left him stranded in Korea during an 8-hour-a-day sweatshop gig that had almost driven Dell to suicide. Dell said no hard feelings, and if I could get a tape to Les, he had some great new material. Everybody agreed that Les hadn't been around in the last couple of weeks. Nobody seemed too concerned about it, and nobody warmed up to me much when I told them I was Les's friend. It was full dark by the time I pulled in front of the St. Pierre's Monte Vista mansion, a 3-story white stucco wedge with a half-acre front yard, 2-car garage, and just enough lit view around the side of the house to confirm that there was a swimming pool and a tennis court. I rang the doorbell for 5 minutes. No Les. No Mrs. St. Pierre. I went back to the VW and sat, pondering a next move. The night clouds darkened and turned the texture of cedar bark. The grackles gave way to the quieter drone of the crickets. In the yellow dashlight, I ran my finger around the pages of Milo's handwriting, looking for nightclubs I hadn't yet visited. My finger kept coming back to one in particular. What the hell? I drove north to see if Tilden Sheckley still wanted to buy me a beer. Chapter 10. I came over the rise of San Geronimo Hill and saw the Indian paintbrush below. The whole expanse of metal building was lit up stark white like some kind of giant UFO hangar. Its 20-foot-high trademark neon wildflower blinked one petal at a time, then flashed all at once. The road sign out front said, "Tammy Vaughn, tonight." Underneath, in smaller letters that obviously hadn't been changed in a long time, it said, "Miranda Daniels, every Saturday night." 2 of the A's in her name missing. Apparently, Tammy Vaughn had some draw. The gravel lot was almost full, and a line of trucks and cars was still snaking in from the access road. Inside the lot, parking attendants jogged around trying to give directions. Waist-deep clouds of shiny dust were rolling through the crisscrossed headlights. After parking the VW, I made my way to the ticket window and through an entrance corridor that smelled like a cattle chute. A bouncer in a Confederate flag t-shirt stamped a little green star on the back of my hand and sent me on into the main hall. The place was not small. A light-gauge bullet shot from the entrance probably would have fallen short of the neon beer signs mounted on either side wall. The ceiling would have been a long shot, too. Along the back wall was an empty stage about 50 feet wide and 5 feet high. Speakers the size of coffins hung from the ceiling, cranking out canned music that sounded vaguely like Alabama. The bar stretched out for a good 40 yards, manned by an army of bartenders in matching red western shirts. Some of the bartenders were busy filling orders, most were not. I walked downstream until I found a particularly bored-looking woman whose name tag read Lena. I ordered a Shiner draft and a shot of Cuervo. "Check around tonight?" I asked. Lena started to make a distasteful face, then froze, suddenly wary. "You a friend?"
"Sheck's got friends?"
Lena smiled. "Amen to that." I told her I was a talent buyer, putting together a promotional, and I was hoping to run some demos past Sheck. I had no idea what I was saying, and neither did Lena, but she was more than willing to point out Tilden Sheckley. He was 40 yards away, at the edge of the dance floor, arguing heatedly with a red-headed woman in a sky-blue jumpsuit.
"I wouldn't count on him being available anytime soon," Lena told me. "Simulcast rights."
"How's that?" She nodded again toward the lady in the jumpsuit.
"Tammy Vaughn's manager. She's gonna demand some rights to the radio broadcast. She'll blame the booking agency for overlooking that when they signed the contract. Sheckley's going to tell her tough shit. Tammy will end up playing the gig anyway, because she needs exposure. Here comes the contract."
Sure enough, just at that moment, Sheckley produced a piece of paper and held it in the woman's face, like he was inviting her to find any line that supported her demand. The manager brushed the paper away and kept arguing.
"Every damn week," Lena told me. "He'll spend half the night arguing with her, the rest of the night trying to get in her pants."
"Suppose I just left a note in his office," I said.
"Upstairs annex, past the bull ring, next to the studio."
She pointed toward the double doors, far off to the right, where the neon bull rider was flickering back and forth on his neon bull. Lena leaned across the bar, gave me a friendly smile.
"Now, you're going to have to buy another drink, honey, or I need to quit talking."
I told her thanks, put a dollar in her pitcher, and got up to leave. Lena sighed.
"The night goes downhill from here."
The bull riding arena was dark. 17 or 18 empty rows of seats sloped down toward the circular pit. Nothing there but some red plastic barrels, rodeo clown props, 2 metal chute gates on the north wall hanging open apathetically. The dirt was scarred and streaked from the last round of boot heels and hooves that had pounded through it.